This is the Made of Clay report, facing our lives. And Peaches Gillette and Eric Clay are your co-hosts. And today we are examining the idea of how we have weaponized language and taken on the role of policing the way we talk about issues.
You know, I kept thinking, I was going over and over this whole concept of this language policing. I'm not sure what to call it. It's actually extremely troubling to me. And it's troubling for a couple of reasons. And the foundational reason, or the first reason it's troubling, is because we're taking just words in general or expressions or language that are just common and relatively neutral and that could be interpreted a million ways, and leaning toward interpreting them in the most negative way so that we can react against them, so that we can control what somebody's saying, as opposed to accepting them or interpreting them with the most generous of possibilities, and then even asking somebody, what did you mean by that, if there's some confusion. Most of the time, people don't even ask, because I think that what has happened is we've gotten so into controlling what people are saying that we don't even really ask anymore what they mean. And at least that's what I'm finding, that people right. just jump immediately to what's negative, and that's what they're criticizing about what you said.
Right, right. And I think the whole idea of asking a question, we don't, it's not that we go straight to the condemnation from my experience. Mm-hmm. It's that people don't know how to ask a question that already isn't presuming an answer.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay. Not an honest question.
Yeah, yeah.
I know, somewhere 20 or maybe 30 years ago or so, I realized that it's not, if I think I know the answer, or if I am using this question to push a person around in a particular way, it's not an honest question.
That's right. That's right.
And most of our questions in public life have been dishonest for at least the last 50 years.
Yeah, I agree that a lot of that's there. And to me, like, I've experienced a lot of the other as well. And I know exactly what you're describing, like, exactly.
And so
it's almost like they want to trap you or something, you know?
Right, right. Right. And so where we started the episode today with Peaches describing what motivates her is this idea that we have weaponized language in a way that makes the words that people use the issue. And then we police the words they use, and it makes them respond rather than have to deal with, why are we upset? What is it that we are getting unraveled by? And the reason Peaches raised this issue is that it's getting in the way of our actually having any conversation, let alone a non-defensive, honest understanding of where we might learn from each other, or where we might agree or disagree, or mm-hmm. or just learn about life.
Yeah, yeah. And it ends up being, you know, the more something becomes part of the culture, also, it also becomes then a self-fulfilling prophecy. In other words, the more the culture starts saying, well, you have to be careful of what somebody's saying, you have no idea what their intention is, and the impact of it is the most important thing and not what they meant to say, then we buy into that psychology even before we actually believe it. We just buy it.
Right.
And we start reacting and responding to it. And so everything becomes inauthentic in a way. You know, the emotional reaction becomes inauthentic. You make the intention of the person not valued. It really causes a mess as far as I'm concerned. And also this, where does it end? You know, when we start kind of revising language or using different expressions because we realize that they've become too insensitive to a group of people, that's one thing. But even that can get out of hand. You know, we keep changing things, and all of a sudden, before you know it, that word's not good. It's like the word, I guess someone said to me, like, the word crippled, right? That's the word we used to use. And then we moved into maybe handicapped, and then we moved into disability, and now we moved into people differently
abled. Yeah.
Right. And rapidly, this has happened rapidly. And so every level of it potentially can become another insulting way to address somebody. And so it keeps moving. So when do we stop, or how much do we just kind of like machete language to the point where we're just uncertain about how to speak to people. And that these are mild cases. We're not even talking about the cases in which people have been sued and lost their jobs and been fired and slandered because they made one mistake or they use a little bit of an outdated word. You know, it gets out of control.
Right. What did you say about authenticity? How does this, we can't be authentic, or how does this damage
because
authenticity?
We're reacting, for example, I'm reacting to a word, not because I really have any kind of emotional aversion to the word, but I'm told I'm supposed to have that.
Right.
So it's not even authentically my emotion.
Right.
It's just something I adopted because the society said you should be offended by that word. So not only am I not thinking or processing my own emotions around that word anymore, I'm not thinking and processing the emotions behind the person who used that word. And so my reaction is really even not authentically mine.
Right.
It's just something
right.
I adopted because
right.
it's like being absorbed by common culture. You know?
Right. And so where I went when you used the word authentic was, and this is authentic comes from to author comes from a Greek word meaning exousia, meaning out of being. And your being is both your intention and the skill with which you execute that intention. And so authenticity is both the intention and the impact. Mm-hmm. And you can, to some degree, control your intention, but that's not even, a lot of that is just in the water of our lives.
Yeah.
But it's different than the skill with which you may try to execute it. And the skill is in relation to things beyond yourself, because mm-hmm. that's where the communication lands. Mm-hmm. When we start policing each other's language, we start justifying structures that are just formal rules for being without ever getting in touch with the being that we are or that they are.
Yeah.
Because we're shadow boxing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. It's just creating another breakdown in communication. Because
right.
you're fumbling over, you're standing, you're trying to have a simple conversation with somebody, and then now you're, not necessarily for me or you or somebody else, but then the other person who has been kind of called out about the word they use, now the communication becomes fumbling around about what you can say, how can you say that, and should I even use the word I'm thinking, because maybe that's going to be an offensive word, and it completely breaks down the communication, whereas if somebody could say, what did you mean, or just trust the intention of the source.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It would be so much more cleaner way to communicate.
Right.
Or to even, I have to say, to even, and I grew up this way, and I was talking to somebody yesterday about that, about part of the kind of culture up here. If someone said, like, I think I told you that, someone, a friend, a really dear friend of
mm-hmm.
mine, once used the word colored, right?
Right.
And all I said to him is like, what century do you think we're in? And that was the end of the conversation.
Yep.
That was it. He got the message. It was a mistake. I didn't even take it hard. You know, I didn't take it in a bad way. And that was it. And we don't do that anymore with anybody.
It was like you swatted a mosquito bite.
Yeah.
Because, and then the mosquito went away.
Yes. Yes. And I don't know why we are unable to do that, especially with our friends.
Right.
You know,
right.
And we've become so, I mean, even saying hypersensitive is almost like mitigating it.
Right. Right.
Because it's really, it's a defensive, it's almost like a defensiveness that an aggressive defensiveness
right.
against what people are trying to say.
Right. I'm going to use an example that happened in a conversation that you and I were in earlier this week,
okay.
because it's relevant. And I think, and but I also want to explore more about specific cases.
Okay.
So we were in a conversation with people who didn't know each other, and there was an older white male who was had a lot of experience teaching in predominantly affluent suburban white school districts. And made some comment about a well-known old style 1940s or 50s style high-rise housing project, or maybe 60s, assuming that Peaches, that as a woman of color, you would know what that kind of inner city situation and the population there was about. And in the midst of a lot of pretty understanding knowledge of how systems break down and reform them and regather themselves with some of the bad behaviors dispersed differently, after this structure was torn down, it just spread all sorts of stuff all around that nobody was really prepared to deal with. Okay. Kind of like just emptying mental health institutions,
sure.
And not having the structures in place, or that's even right. Warning communities ahead of time, you need to figure this out.
Right.
Anyway, but your work, you asked him the question, why did you assume I would know the students from that place? And he was assuming that you had worked in education with inner city public school students and not in a fairly elite private school setting. And even though you grew up in a situation closer to what he was describing, but two generations different, you know, much less severe, much less, but in very, not at public housing at all. But I mean, it was in terms of the poverty piece closer, but not the same context at all. Everything is very specific. Yeah, yeah. And I grew up in a right rural, poor community, and there were ways in which it was closer to me than it was what he was projecting onto you. But you just asked, why did you think that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so I find those things so interesting. And, I we grew up.
So why do you, how did you come to find those things interesting? When did you learn to question about those things rather than to assert about those things? Well, I don't see it that way. How did you discover a different response, and what makes it curious? What are you curious?
You know, I think that I just, most of my life, I've always been curious about how people come to the thinking that they come to. How do they come to that? I want to see, I'm a person of detail. Even when I think about things I want to talk about, I think about, okay, how does this first thing connect to that second thing, and so on and so forth. And that's always been the way it was, whether it was with people's thinking or examining insects on the sidewalk or whatever it was, that's the way I've been. And I think that's part of it, is like, I really want to know, like, what put that thought together? Because that thought, that one little thought, took a whole process to put together. And I want to know what that process was to put that thought together. And if you could answer me in a couple of words or a couple of phrases, that's great. But I really am curious about what puts those things together.
Right. You know? So, in everyday life, this is what you. So what you have done is you've morphed what is a traditionally spiritual development question: how have you come to believe what you believe, into a more just social sciencey or just an everyday life question of how have you come to be the person you are, to hold the opinion that you hold or hold the experience that you hold.
Yes, and in that great process, like, If someone could really stop and think, okay, what, how did I come to think about that? It's so beautiful to watch them learning from examining their own process of thinking,
right,
which most people don't do. And so I like that part of it as well, you know, because sometimes you can see it by watching people, as they're thinking about what you just asked them, you can see their wheels turning and something more is going on. And I think that, and for me, that's a wonderful part of us, all of us, and the way our minds work. And I like that.
Right. Right. You have asked them to understand the framing of their life. Mm-hmm. And we're often asked about our opinions or our experiences as outcomes.
Yes.
But not about the process by which we constructed that opinion. And what's even harder is our visceral responses to things, or our even softer emotional responses. Very often we don't even know how to think about how we lined up experiences, so that the resulting visceral reaction or the resulting feeling was inevitable in some sense.
Yes. Yes. And just on the side of that, that's why the whole concept of teaching children critical thinking, it usually fails, because we ourselves don't know how to do our own critical thinking in terms of analyzing how we got from this step to that other step.
Right. Right. But what I'm, so you, you're challenging it on the basis of honesty, and I want to challenge it on the basis on a particular kind of dishonesty. Analytical thinking in the public schools is rationalistic. It does not root itself in profound feelings of joy or desire or revulsion or rage. It does not root itself in feelings of love or compassion or a humor. It's not thinking that's grounded in a life. And would never work. Critical thinking that's not grounded in a person, in a whole person's life, will never work.
Right, right. And that's part of the failing of it, because even when if you're teaching it in school, the concept of critical thinking is not relegated to this one little area of academics. And if we taught in a way that we realize that we really, whatever we're talking, teaching and saying, is basically the experience of somebody's life, even if it's not the life of the student that we were talking about.
Right.
You know, it's interesting.
Right. And
we're so narrow. We're very narrow.
Right. Right. And so I don't want to move too quickly or in a direction that we shouldn't, but what you have described in terms of getting at the way we compose, we prepare ourselves for the experiences that we have, and then we can explain them to others. And when we can learn to explain them to others, we can also learn to change them. But if we're under constant attack for our experiences, then we're not going to really understand how they've come into being, and we're not going to really be able to change them.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, because it's not that I'm not, I was going to say I'm not easily offended. I can make that statement. But even if I am offended, I don't get caught up in it. I can still ask a rational question, as opposed to some people, when you offend them, it just goes into like fight mode. And I'm just going to attack back or shut you down or, you know, put you in your place or whatever the language is.
Right, right, right. And I have witnessed you with the boiler steam coming out of the top of your head, mm-hmm. but your actions are measured.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And that kind of emotional regulation, I think, is what you want to get at with this particular conversation.
That's right.
And what I want to do is, I think we need to cut to music, but is there something that comes to mind that would be really useful at this particular moment?
I would love to play Orange Sky. I love that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Orange Sky. Here we go. Thank you.
I had a dream. I stood beneath an orange sky. Yes, I had a dream. I stood beneath an orange sky. With my brother standing by. My brother standing by. I said, brother, you know, it's a long road we've been walking on. Yes, it is, you know, brother, it is. Such a long road we've been walking on. Beneath an orange sky, with my sister standing by, with my sister standing by. I said, here is what I know now, sister. Here is what I know now goes with in your my salvation lies in your love. My salvation lies in your love. My salvation lies in your love. In your love. In your love. Oh, but you know I am so. Sometimes, sometimes my mind is too strong to carry on. Too strong to carry on. But when I'm alone, when I've thrown off the weight of this crazy stone, when I've lost all care for the things I own, that's when I miss you. That's when I miss you, you who are my home. Sister goes like this. In your love, my salvation lies in your love. 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 In your love, in your love. Your love now. My brother and my sister standing by. my brother and my sister standing by now. With my brother and my sister standing by.
This is the Made of Clay Report, Facing Our Lives. Peaches Gillette is a co-host. I'm Eric Clay and a co-host, and we are exploring the consequences of how of having weaponized our language, and how can we regulate our emotion without needing so much to control others? Because that need for control keeps us from understanding ourselves. It also prevents them from stepping out of whatever stuck place they may be in, which just entrenches us all.
Absolutely.
So
it also eliminates, I'm sorry.
Go right ahead.
It also completely eliminates it for me. And I've said this before, when I meet someone, there is a certain level of mutuality that's just transpiring immediately when I meet you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not there for you to take care of. You're not there. Or we mutually take care of one another.
Or we attend to each other. If you
that
want
is
to use
exactly
language,
right.
It's less caretaking.
That's exactly
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
And so you go into a situation, I use a word like church,
uh-huh.
right? Someone feels triggered or whatever the language is that right. they want to use to make you feel like you did something to just compromise all of their emotions. And now suddenly I'm responsible for that, as opposed to them being responsible to manage and regulate their own emotional reactions and responses. And so it shifts the entire sense of mutuality immediately.
Right. It's not mutual at all.
The whole dynamic of the relationship.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. 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 And so I'm going to trot out a word. You just used the word church.
Okay.
But for me, when I had the profoundly ironic experience of going from being a college scholar at Cornell to mm-hmm. a few years after graduation, being at Union Seminary in New York. And at Cornell, I worked with the founders of cutting edge programs in biology and society and issues around sexuality and childbearing and reproduction issues around here and abortion and issues around end of life care, really, really rich stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But in my experience at Cornell, only 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 professors could actually fundamentally challenge the basis of their very discipline.
Okay. Yep.
Their very beliefs. In seminary, it was 1 in 2.
Okay.
The level of the ability to hold lightly what you thought and to be able to be open to having it taken apart and learning from others and maybe allowing for things you didn't understand to exist because you could see the integrity of that other thing, even though it didn't make sense on some level.
Yep.
There was no reason to be offended by it.
Yes.
That was powerful. And it didn't fit my Cornell professors' stereotypes. They thought I was going to seminary to shut off my mind.
Yeah.
That I would could be indoctrinated. And I went to seminary
and
said, hey, you can be a teacher and not be indoctrinating the students around you.
Yes. That's
and
right.
that was like, whoa. But what changed it for me in that moment was the word religion,
mm-hmm.
religare, to religament,
mm-hmm.
to bind the world, to bind together again, to religament,
yes.
to put it, our ligaments are what holds our bodies together. Without them, we would just be a mess.
A mess.
a little bit of a gelatinous mess.
A floppy thing. Right?
Floppy thing. Anyway, so because I come from a tradition that tends to really push seeing all people as equal, I began to then see that I grew up in an environment where we looked at each other as a walking religious tradition.
Mm-hmm, okay.
If I am going to get to know you, I need to know how the world is put together for you, because that's how you're put together.
Yes.
And you know how you're put together when your life has been torn apart and you've had to put it back together.
That's right.
So
that's
I do well to listen to you, even if I don't understand the words, even if I don't
that's
like
right.
the words,
that's right.
even if it's because that is what's at stake.
That is right. That's right.
And
there's
an
essence that spills off of things far beyond the words. And we disconnected ourselves from that,
yeah, yeah.
you know? And those are the things, that essence is also what makes us know someone else.
Right.
You know?
Right. Right. And yet if the word religion or religious triggers this other person, which I soon discovered that it did, if they weren't triggered so far as to utterly just stop listening.
Okay.
I could say, this is what it means that's different than your assumption. Can you go to me for the meaning and not for the word? Mm-hmm. If the word shuts you down, come with me to the meaning and show me how you're put together.
Yes. Yes.
And I'll show you.
Yeah.
And your language isn't going to make sense to me necessarily, or mine to you. But we can, in conversation, discover what we might do together, how we might support, challenge, encourage, deepen one another.
Yes. Yeah. And again, even to say like, okay, even without saying, don't use that word or implying that you shouldn't use that word, how about let's share what that word means to each of us,
right?
And
right.
Maybe we'll find something, because you never know, you might go oh right, I didn't think of it that way, right. Or I didn't think of your side that way,
right?
And maybe we can form a different kind of mutuality without always having to police and eliminate all these words,
right? And I'm going to you have just stated an extremely mature response to challenging another person's use of words. I want to say something that's kind of in the middle.
Okay.
And that is, and particularly around the word religion, I could say to them, I know I'm using a loaded word. I want you to hear what it means. I'm also using the loaded word knowing that it's going to trigger you, but I'm warning you not in order to make it not push, but so that you can try to hold on to the critical part of it. Because it's a word that's been really important to some people. Yeah. And the whole idea in this nation of freedom of religion isn't the freedom to believe kooky things and to have funny little isolated private experiences. Freedom of religion is to have the freedom of your way of life without interference from others, unless your way of life is interfering with the freedom of others.
That's right.
And when we get to it, which is one of the ironic positive things of having a Supreme Court with more conservative members, because that more way of life thing may actually has a chance of getting out of this modernist rigid notion of what it means to be good.
Yes.
That we can move with a little more complexity.
Yeah.
It may not go there. It may go to a more populist authoritarian way, but the modernity was authoritarian in its own way and unwilling to suffer others.
And it's also nice to have I always hesitate to use the word balance, not because I've weaponized it, but because it's not necessarily a balance, but it's also important for me to, like I was saying before, to not take something that can be very simple and a gentle way of communicating and turn it into this overblown,
right,
analytically, you know, like it just, I mean, like I said about the word color, like I said about anything, sometimes I would say to somebody, hey, it's like I say, you know, I love chocolate donuts.
Right.
But you hate chocolate donuts. They remind you of a time that you ate too many and you got sick. I get that.
Right.
That doesn't have to change the fact that chocolate donuts are so good to people.
And are good to somebody and good to the person in front of you.
Religion is the same
way. And so I will take your comment, whether you intended it that way or not, as a gentle pushback to not over intellectualize and not raise the stakes in my own response. So what I could say, and a lot of times these middle of the road or the middle of the ground responses get us into problems. What I could say is, I respect your desire for a life of integrity. I don't understand what you mean by integrity here, or I have a different set of values and my integrity feels differently and I need something else.
Yes, that's right.
And in effect, that is what freedom of religion allows for.
That's right. That's right. Exactly.
And that getting to that spot and getting there quicker. In this middle ground, we can try to acknowledge the troubles that it's causing for us, but not be very skillful at addressing them.
I guess it depends on who's approaching it. Like, I think that a middle, I don't even know if it's a middle ground.
Okay, so
it's like an alternative way to deal with the situation. Right?
And what I'm trying to say is that people for whom there are clear right and wrong answers, to go to the to just utter curiosity about what's out there usually requires a few steps.
Right.
And what I mean is that by middle ground isn't a compromised space.
Yes.
It's the path that you have to walk through to get from being absolutely certain for not only yourself but everybody else that this is ethics.
Yes.
This is valuable.
Yeah.
And to the capacity to, what did you mean when you made that comment or why did you expect me to understand the people mm-hmm. who live in that particular mm-hmm. housing complex? Mm-hmm. You know, you can ask that question with such a light heart that you don't expect a particular answer, it frees up the space.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a period of time where we the living that we have to go through from feeling like there are right answers and we have them.
Absolutely.
To the fact that we may have the answer that is right for us, it may not be right for anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I used to get triggered by people and their pets.
Mm-hmm.
And because I see pets as a form of slavery.
Okay. Yep.
And a precise analog to house slaves.
Yes. Okay.
For the regulating the mood and the emotions for the quote owners in the house.
Yes. And oh yes, I understand.
Rather than taking, and so that's what, in many ways, that's what pets are doing.
Oh yeah.
and they have no more freedom than those slaves.
Yeah.
And what freedom they have is a condescension.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And so I want no part of that, and I'm really clear about that.
Yes.
Where I failed was that for many people, pets are the most gentle relationship they'll ever have in their life.
That's right.
The least complicated one they've ever had.
Yes, that is right.
And for me, that's a sign that they failed to learn to regulate their emotions and their situations, and they have to do it with a pseudo person, with a pet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The fact that I see it that way is my judgment.
Yeah.
I am completely unwavering in that judgment,
mm-hmm.
but I don't expect them to share it. And when they come to my house with pets, I treat the pet with utmost respect.
Yes.
And I treat them with respect because I would want that same thing as well.
Yes.
When my judgment about pets was so extreme, I couldn't give them the space to be solving their own lives' problems in the ways that make the most sense to
mm-hmm.
them.
Mm-hmm.
If there is space for this conversation about how we can learn to emotionally manage ourselves better, then yes, then maybe we can have that and they can see it. But and I was in another situation where a person brought in a pet to the event, and it took almost the whole 2-hour event for that person to realize, oh, I expect that I should feel judged, but I don't feel judged.
Okay. Yeah. It's, you know, it's all, part of the issue is, and you know, I've owned pets. I don't own any pets. I love my guinea pig. there is the element, I won't get off of that because it can sidetrack what we're talking about. You, if you inherit an animal, you find it, whatever,
mm-hmm.
and you love it because that's what you end up doing.
Right. Yeah. It's honest.
And we need to love.
Yes.
We don't just need to be loved. We need to love.
And we love in whatever circumstances we find
that
ourselves.
That is exactly right. That is exactly right. And at least guinea pigs are very hard to have as pets because they can't do a thing for anybody. As slaves, they can't do a thing for anybody. But the idea, going back to language and words and things like that, when I originally said authentic, I meant the things that are real to your nature.
Yes.
In that sense. When we take on a concept because it is the current cultural concept, and we don't really, and if the next month when another concept comes up, we'll get rid of this one, we'll take on that one, because we do that all the time. It's not authentic to the system, that process to which we came to believe something.
Right.
When we make other people, there has to be a shared responsibility of attending to one another.
Right.
Right. That doesn't happen when somebody is literally almost beating you over the head because of a word that you chose to use that means something to you. It's not like you chose that word because you wanted to be offensive.
Right.
But it means something. So ask them, what does it mean to you?
Right.
Humble yourself instead of putting yourself in a position where you have to control the situation and they have to be responsible for your emotions.
Mm-hmm.
Put your emotions aside for a minute and just say to them, why does that word mean something to you? As opposed to the statement becomes, my emotions are more important than yours. You have to attend to my emotions by not using that word. I don't have to ask you what that word means to you. You see how the dynamics get really muddy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And the way you've taken this conversation has helped me to see a connection that was floating around in my mind. And that is when you are policing other people's words, you're defending an institutional ideal of what should be rather than living with what is.
Yeah.
And there was a time in where I grew up with, we had two different kinds of police officers. Those who would actually question, what were you doing? Mm-hmm. What were you thinking?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they would figure out in a fairly subtle way what was going on. And oftentimes that didn't have to end with anybody being attacked.
Yes.
You know, one of my friends did get shot in a hail of 110 bullets because the police were acting badly. But it's those who would not try to be curious about what was happening would try to emphasize order or in control. And they ended any responsible relationship.
Yes, yes.
And they actually, the impact of their behavior was the opposite.
Yes. Yeah.
And you are calling us in this your interest in this topic to have those direct conversations. So we're not trying to protect any structure. We're just trying to do the best we can with the people we're with.
That is exactly right. The person, literally the person you are standing with right now. And also to take into consideration, you know, you're talking to a stranger, that's a whole different thing, because then you're processing things, you're looking at each other in a different way, you're trying to
and you're triangulating assumptions and stuff.
That's exactly right.
Yeah,
you know, you're getting rid of stuff, you're putting in things. You're talking to somebody you know them, you know that they're not out to hurt you. You know, we have to trust that sometimes. And if somebody says something, and I'm not, the chances of some word coming out of my mouth that's offensive, really, it's not just kind of a neutral word where you made a personal association with that word on your own that made that word triggering to you. I didn't do that.
Right.
Take responsibility for that.
Right. If I am feeling insecure and have issues with authority, I may unselfconsciously use a word that triggers you.
Mm-hmm.
To pounce on the word fails to address the my lack of being able to be comfortable in your presence.
That's exactly right.
And that is on me and on you.
Yeah. And even to say, And to be open, this is the other thing. Even if you said to somebody, that word makes me feel this way, that right. word triggers me, right?
Right.
And I'm not talking about words that are specific designed to hurt people, like racial slurs and things like that. I'm just talking about words. You said to somebody, that word makes me feel this way or triggered in this way. It brings up this emotional stuff in me. Your responsibility is also to be open enough to receive the fact that I might say, I don't feel that way. I'm not necessarily going to stop using that word.
Right. Right. You know? And for me, it constantly come, not constantly, but it's often come back among among some people that when I talk about, we must know how to fight in relationships. And that word for some people, they can't imagine anything other than a brawl.
Right, right.
You know, right. And so they have already been triggered. And yes. so if they even share with me the fact that they've been triggered, that's a step in the right direction. And then once they share with me the fact that they can be triggered, if they have the space to hear that I use that word to show that we need to be able to be at that point where we are out of control over something, or just on the edge of being out of control over something that matters incredibly importantly, and use the means that we have some sense will get us there. Sometimes it's physical posturing. Sometimes it's restraining. Sometimes it's using words. It's actually sometimes it's melting.
Yes.
You know, and so fighting is this whole repertoire. And for me, it's this rich thing. And I talk about conflict in the same way, but it triggers people who have a really strong assumption. And I need to be a responsible human being in the world as it is now. I have to recognize that.
Right. Right.
And the deal and deal with it. But also, if people can come back to me and say, I think you're full of it.
Full of it. I agree. I agree. And that to me is, if there's a middle ground, that is it, that you have to be able to accept on some level the same way you want me to accept. That's what the problem is. You want me to accept the fact that you're triggered and you don't want to hear that word and blah, blah. And so in one of the realities, I should be able to turn around to you and say, okay, what are you going to offer me for that? If I'm taking the responsibility if we're bartering, right?
Right.
You're telling me that you want this from me.
Right.
Now I'm going to ask you what you're giving me back for that. That would be a ridiculous way to have a conversation. It'd be in a relationship. So why are you taking something from me and not offering me anything?
Right.
All you're doing is controlling me and saying you just need to be controlled.
Right, right. To stay with this example that I lined out before about fighting, the person was trying to say to me, if you would just learn these alternatives to violence communication strategies, you wouldn't need any of this right. that you're talking about.
That's right.
To which I would say, yes, I have actually done some of that training. It doesn't speak to the visceral experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a language that communicates to me or people often that I care about, though it does to some.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't dismiss it, but it's not effective.
No,
and
absolutely.
Yes, you wish for me to have a way of experiencing passion and difference that is less viscerally engaging, mm-hmm. but I'm dealing with your personality type. I'm not dealing with my personality type.
Right.
You know, and yes, there are times when I want to calm down and I want to know how to regulate that.
Yeah.
But I also want to know how to ramp it up to be comfortable in spaces where people might go crazy, but I'm just, you know, I'm really comfortable there.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. I understand completely. I mean, I've said to people, you know what, you're just going to have to sit with that feeling. Yeah. I've said that to people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's
yeah.
your feeling.
No, and,
yeah. If you want to share it with me, that's great.
I can't change the feeling, but I don't deny that it's there. And I
exactly.
don't deny that you associate that feeling with me.
That's right.
I didn't intend to provoke it, but I have, or you experiencing me has, and I can't. You know, I can't, I told a friend.
I'm not even trying.
Yeah.
That's what my attitude
right,
is sometimes.
Right.
I'm not even trying. Also, what comes out of that for me is that this other person, right, who's triggered by this word, this one word, a neutral word, has just reduced me down to that thing. You see, I there's so much of me that doesn't offend you, that won't trigger you, that did not, in fact, trigger you right at that very moment. Why don't we go into that area?
Right.
Instead of being stuck on that one word that I said, as opposed to like, let's just put that aside for a minute and let's get to know one another. Because sometimes when you get to know one another, that same exact word will not have the same impact, I'm telling you.
Right. Or yeah, I mean, what I think about are every culture, every community has its different ways of greeting. And each person is, you know, some people are comfortable shaking hands and some people are not. And some people are comfortable with a perfunctory cheek to cheek or even kiss. And some people are not. And it's just like, you know, I don't mean to offend you, but how are you comfortable greeting? You know, mm-hmm. do you not like to be touched like that? I don't right. need to touch you in a way that upsets you.
Yeah. That's right.
Let's cut to music, and I want at this point to play a Jackson Browne song. It's great. Probably 50 years old at this point, or more. From Late for the Sky, where it's kind of this haggling, just the weight of having haggled over differences in words and not being great. Able to resolve them. Because I think what we're trying to do is to. We're talking about it. We're not enacting these mm-hmm. triggering moments, mm-hmm. but we are talking about how we might respond to them that would be a little different. Yeah. But this is when it didn't work. Mm-hmm.
Somehow the feeling still wasn't right, and still we continued on through the night. Tracing our steps from the beginning until they vanished into the air. Trying to understand how our lives had led us there. Looking hard into your eyes, there was nobody I'd ever known. Such an empty surprise. Feeling we've known. and close to the end of the feeling.
This is the Made of Clay Report, Facing Our Lives. Peaches Gillette and Eric Clay are your co-hosts. We welcome your comments on any aspect of this conversation about weaponizing language and policing the use of words with each other. Any comments, any suggestions you have, call 607-319-5445, extension 6, and leave a message. That's 607-319-5445, extension 6, and leave a message. Or you can write an email to info@madeofclay.org. This show is available online at madeofclay.org. Again, 607-319-5445, extension 6. Or info@madeofclay.org.
Thank you. And we need this conversation to be much larger. We need many voices involved in this conversation.
Right. So yes. So that we need it. What we are doing is because, you know, as two people doing this on a volunteer basis, we have a lot of friends. We have a lot of conversations. That's the nature of our lives. But we need you to step up with your comments and also to come on to the air with us in conversation. We pre-record these shows. We may do them live as soon as we can, but we need your voices with us. This is the Made of Clay Report. Facing Our Lives. Peaches Gillette and Eric Clay are your co-hosts. And we are exploring some of the opportunities of avoiding weaponizing language and some of the consequences of what we lose when we do weaponize language. So Peaches, in this spirit, you brought up the word church. I brought up the word religion. Are there other words that you would like for us to spend a little time with?
Yes, let me think. I think of like these, I was kind of in my head, I was thinking of this words like that that seem very simple to me, that have powerful meaning to one person, even if it doesn't for another person.
Right.
It kind of stays because I'm so involved in church right now.
Right.
A lot of it goes
even in a congregation that doesn't formally call itself a church.
I know.
It's referred to as a church by
it is.
Anybody not in it, and even many of the people who are.
That's exactly right. Yes. And it has the word church on the door, front door.
Right, but not in its formal name.
No, that's right. It can be very, yes.
Yep.
The word prayer. Is Ooh, another one of those words.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Yep.
That can make people go into a tizzy
mm-hmm.
Just by using it. even when, if you don't say, some people, like, if you say, I'll pray for you, I get it. They're like, you know, that's not my thing. But even to say, I pray myself, someone says, oh, that word triggers me. It just reminds me of all this Christianity and then violence. And, you know, how far are we going to take this?
Right.
And so now the conversation is not what it could have been, which could have been like a friendly, loving, how are you doing? How's your family conversation? And now it turns into almost a political, a language political conversation about the word prayer.
Right.
So much that we're pushing out of our relationships.
Right, right, right. And so, so prayer for, I want to relate to some of the ways that the term prayer can be triggering.
Sure.
So you said that it provoked in that person a sense of violence and power, and what was the other, Christianity?
And Christianity, yeah.
And Christianity. For my, the experience that people have shared with me when the word prayer is used is it's magical thinking.
Yes.
It's
yes.
Begging. It's, yes. It's a fancy language that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
You know, all of these and very intense judgments. And, you know, there are times when all of those judgments have actually been true. I mean, when prayer has been used in ways that have been, you know, forced prayer in the public schools, adding under God in the 1950s to the pledge, you know, all these sorts of things are make the word prayer. There are problems in the way it's been used, but you want to focus, and I want to focus for the purpose of today's conversation on how, you know, when the word prayer triggers you, what can we do about that?
There are a couple of things. Like, I loved what you said about magical thinking and things like that. And I just want to address that, because if someone said that to me, if they use that expression, magical thinking, I might say to them, but I like magical thinking.
I mean, so magic.
So now where do we go? Do you see how stifling it could all be? It's just absurd.
Right.
Not
right,
to mention
right.
the fact that I can say, like I said this to a group of people I was sitting with. I said, if I wanted to lean into the things that could possibly trigger me, I wouldn't be sitting with any white person ever. Because if you think white people aren't triggers to black people, they can be.
Yeah.
So where do we draw the line with making you responsible for what I'm feeling, one? And two, where do we draw the importance of finding a way to be in a decent, loving relationship aside from those words that may trigger you? It triggers you. But why does that have to compromise our relationship or the way we're engaging right now? And that's what I find a big problem.
Mm-hmm. So how do you respond? I mean, with something that you gave me an analysis of what's going on there and what the consequences are in real time, how do you respond to, you know, ick? What do you mean prayer? Or I would never pray.
Many ways.
Yep.
Sometimes I say, oh my God, I love prayer. That's it.
Right.
I'm just like, okay, so now if you want to carry this conversation further, you can tell me how much you hate it. I'll go into how much I love it. And it just gets ridiculous, as opposed to, okay, you told me that it triggers you. I told you it feels good to me. Okay, now to me, the conversation is done. Let's move on to something else.
Well, here's where I want to maybe take a step that's one
step good.
Too far into analysis.
Okay.
But when the person says, you know, prayer is just loaded with these negative images, this power play, this, you know, violent thing, or magical thinking. And you say, oh my, I love prayer. When you expose the joy that it is to you, and it is not horror to you, then they may come back with, oh, I didn't realize, you know, you're somebody I either respect or I want to respect, and you find you are prayer is a source of joy for you. I don't get it. And curiosity is where it could come in me. And if their genuine disgust is, you know, how did you come to have such horror? But you can't honestly ask them about the horror that prayer raises, specter that prayer raises for them, until you've shared the utter joy that it raises for mm-hmm. you. And so you both have had opening salvos.
That's exactly right.
And but the curiosity can only happen after the opening salvo. So this is a little bit about how we can respond. So being honest about what triggers you, as long as you're not trying to beat somebody over
the
head.
That's exactly right.
And you're not taking it as a beating, so to speak. You're taking it as a chance to state unabashedly what you feel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then you can either walk away from it.
That's right.
Or somebody can express curiosity.
That's exactly right. That's right. Everything, you know, and I talked about this even when we're doing, like, we were doing when in parts of anti-racism, when they try to teach people how to respond.
Right.
When racist statements and things like that. And my whole attitude is like, you know, that there are times when you actually don't have to say anything. You could actually walk away.
Right.
That is one of the ways to respond.
Right.
Everything does not have to turn into a long-winded psychological conversation about something necessarily, depending on a lot of things, like context, time, whether my state, frame of mind,
right.
whatever it is. One time somebody said to me, well, I think they were referring to the word Christianity or something, and how it just reminds them of all the violence that's been done and the control that's been taken. And I said, how come you're not triggered by the word science and politics in that case? Because all of those things, yeah. all of those ideologies have been responsible for utter destruction on this planet. Where, how did you get stuck there?
Right, right. Or what? Or, yeah. Or yeah. How did you get stuck there? Was meaning, why are you stuck on the word Christianity yeah. and not on these other words?
Yes.
And that's an interesting conversation, probably even to the person who's stuck on Christianity.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They didn't know how to respond.
Well, they yeah. And the thing is then you can stand in silence.
That's exactly right.
And just let the silence speak.
And sometimes that's what I'm aiming for.
Right. But when you said you can walk away, this is, you know, learning to walk away was something that was really hard for me to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the biggest and it wasn't because I needed to win.
Okay.
It's because I needed to find a release for all of the energy that was in me around a topic or an issue.
Okay. Yeah,
and
I understand.
The continued arguing or verbalization was a release.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can also, you can shake your shoulders. Without making a gesture that is aimed at the other person or
That's
persons,
right.
you can do a gesture that releases that tension.
That's right.
And then walk away. But if you don't do that gesture, all of that emotional and visceral response is emotional regulation. This is what I think you wanted to talk about.
Yes.
And one of the ways to walk away is to know how to shake out.
That's right.
So that, or to walk to another space where you can then, you can shake your arms
That's
or
right.
you can scream or vent or whatever.
That's
but
right.
In that moment, just walking away
yeah.
makes sense.
Delay the emotion.
To delay the emotion.
Or to sometimes even completely diffuse it. It's just gone.
Right.
For
because,
me.
Well, if and this is when you're really skillful with something and you know just exactly how much explosive is in that particular comment and you've also let it go before, you can see it and then watch it disappear.
Yeah.
And I just use the gesture with my thumb and index finger
yep.
holding the intense power, the explosive thing, and then just letting it open
oh, yeah.
and go. And that's those kinds of gestures. heal.
Yeah. There's a way. It is not very easy for me to get stuck, is what I'm saying. And I think sometimes people get stuck in their own emotions in terms of that whatever feeling comes up when that thing triggers them.
Right.
And they just can't let it go. They have to bring you into it. You have to be a part of it with them. You have to be responsible for it. They just can't let it go. Where even if something triggered me, depending on what it is, I might go, yeah. Sometimes I might go, yeah, that person's a jerk, and walk away. Sometimes I might go, oh my God, I got to call my friend Patricia and let her know what happened. But I don't necessarily have to make you stand there and deal with it with me.
Right, right.
Or sometimes I just go away and think it out and think like, oh, what did that really, what went on there? What was going on? You know, that kind of thing, you know? Right. And we need to have all of those alternate ways of dealing with our own emotions so that we don't end up beating other people over the head and in essence, making them responsible for how we're regulating and dealing with and modulating our own ways of being. And also, for me, what the other thing that this does to constantly affirm those triggers is to help keep people stuck. There are a million things you can associate with one single word. You happen to land on that one thing, and whatever it is in you that made you do that, I get it, that's fine, but you really don't have to do that. And I'm very much into like, let's be a little more in charge with our own minds and the way we think, where we have given up, we've relinquished control and we want everybody else to help us be control or control them so that they don't make us feel triggered, whatever it is that we're doing. But we won't take responsibility for saying, we are a beautiful animal. We have an amazing mind. It's incredible. And we can make better use of it.
Right. 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 And I'm almost so it's been a long time. I find myself doing this more now, but it's been a long time since I've seen other people do it where they've said, I overreacted to you.
Very good, yes.
And I had an incident where I challenged a person of color about relating to a group of older white, predominantly white men.
Okay.
Predominantly older white men. The predominant was older. Turns out that this person has a white father.
Mm-hmm.
So the interaction made a whole lot more sense.
Sure.
But none of us knew that.
Right,
it was still a question. There were still things, and what I was able to say when this person said, "One of the things you don't know about me is that I have a white father,"
mm-hmm.
and I said, "It gives all sorts of nuance and meaning to what happened that I didn't see."
Yeah,
it didn't change my read or the way I would say she was being read by others. But it gave me a tremendous insight into the challenge of living that this person has.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. No, I understand. Yeah. And yes, absolutely.
And it humbled me because my comment to this person was useful. But it was also coming back to me with that detail was incredibly useful for me to know this person.
Yeah.
And I just, we didn't know each other.
Okay. Yes.
Not in that way.
Yes, exactly.
You know?
Yeah. 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 You know, it's people have, there's so much of us, of course, it's just so normal that we have these strands of connections to things. That's just life. Mm-hmm. You know, I could look at like when I walk in a house and there I see all these little magnets sitting on the kitchen counter that I haven't moved. They need to be put where the magnets are. I haven't moved them because they remind me of Lennox. And so I leave them sitting on the counter so that every time I walk in, I could think of Lennox.
And Lennox is your beloved grandchild.
Oh my God, yes. Yes. He is. Okay, so all of us have these beautiful, some of those connections are so beautiful, even if they're sad.
Yeah.
Are so amazingly beautiful.
Yep.
So I get that part. But I could also create another association with those magnets. I could, even though they'll always remind me of Linux, I could think of a million other associations for that magnet. Like the fact that I loved magnets when I was a child, it reminded me of being an educator, things like that. So I have a million associations with magnets. I like the magic of magnets, like all of that stuff. But to land on the most, and I know this is a human tendency, to land on the most painful things, because we have to filter those in a very different way. We have to filter pain differently than happiness. But to make somebody else responsible is where I draw the line. You could invite me in to sitting with you with that pain. That's different than trying to shut me down because a word I used reminds you of that pain. That is a very different way of being with other people.
Right. So the technique then is when you have been challenged because somebody has triggered, your words have triggered somebody, then if I were to respond with that skillfully, I would say, can you show me the pain that gave rise to that reaction? Because I am not the incident of pain, but there is something that gave rise to that reaction.
That's right. And then if I were in my different quote unquote counseling head, the way I think, I would actually try to help somebody change or add a different association.
Right. I guess, and I want to honor your instinct, but I want to slow down the process a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, the first thing is, are people reacting to something that they have directly experienced?
Mm-hmm.
Or are they reacting to what they've heard is a common experience, but it's so they're trying to be virtuous, but they don't have an actual experience of the vice that would occasion the need to be virtuous?
That is exactly the question.
And if they say that I've never experienced it, then the conversation becomes,
yes,
I didn't provoke it in you because you hadn't experienced it.
That's right.
I provoked some sense of your needing to promote righteousness.
And that's what comes about with all those words like church and Christianity things like that.
Right.
And that's what I mean. It's not an authentic feeling, that sense that it didn't originate from.
Well, some people have been shunned or run out of church. I was physically run out of town.
That is true.
You know, we can talk about that.
Right.
But yes, but for many people, it's adopted offense.
Absolutely.
And so.
And that's okay too, right?
Well, it's okay,
right?
But so, and this is what the beauty of talking with you and working on this is: if a person is offended by the term church, but they themselves have never been harmed by a church,
then.
And some people obviously have had wonderful experiences, and mine have been extremely mixed.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding of fundamentalism is when you enforce the form of a religion without having a clue about its content.
Yep.
And all you want is perfunctory obedience.
Yes.
But you want it, whether it's the wearing of a veil in a particular way in Iran, or it's the saying particularly progressive mantras here, secular mantras here in the US, it is the same fundamentalism where the show matters more than the substance. So I think, and here is where it gets critical, is I don't want to see you as a fundamentalist when you have tried to police me. I want to see you as a human being who's struggling with a way to promote righteousness in a world, righteousness that's grounded in the real complexity of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are trying to change my behavior or hold me accountable for something you feel deeply that I have not actually done or you have not experienced it, that is not furthering righteousness. That's not in the world. That is not addressing the systemic injustice that we all live with.
And that is, in my experience, what is going on most of the time when people are policing words. And not to mention that the idea of policing words becomes a pattern and habit of the culture. And therefore, they're doing it because they feel like that's what we ought to be doing, because that's what the society says that we should be doing.
Right, right.
Words. That's right.
Right, right.
And that's been my experience. It's empty. It's an empty way of controlling somebody.
You know, right.
Or
right.
getting attention. It could be
right.
either.
Right. I can't help but think about kind of the history of studying different political and economic systems, and Soviet and communist systems used to try to centrally manage by eavesdropping on everybody and,
yes.
and by collecting gossip from neighbors. And the joke was that in capitalism, everybody is out there to enforce it on everybody else.
Right.
And we have kind of taken that capitalistic model to
That's
language.
Right. That is exactly right.
And it's actually as lethal
that is exactly
as the communist right. state.
That is exactly right. It's damaging. It's doing
right.
damage. And
right.
we're not, and some of us are in the real slow boil and we're not seeing how damaging it's becoming.
Right. Right.
You know?
Right.
The other thing is, well, it's interesting, and this is just personal thought. I have had my share of damage from churches,
mm-hmm.
and I've watched my mother have her share of damage from churches. Yet I don't come out of it trying to police the word church, because that's not really the association for me. The association
right.
is not the church on the bottom line of everything. The association, you can use church to do damage. You can use politics and science and all those other things to do damage. But what's really doing the damage is the fact that we have a compromised humanity and we damage people that way. And that's the way I look at things. And that's why those words don't trigger me, because that's not my association to them. My association is always back down to the hands of the human being that was using that as a tool. It's not the tool.
Right, right, right. I'm going to suggest that at this moment we cut to a song, More Than Words by Extreme. And I have a very specific place that we want to come back to after we listen to this song.
Say I love you is not the words I want to hear from.
This is the Made of Clay Report, Facing Our Lives. And Peaches Gillette and Eric Clay are your co-hosts. And today we are examining the idea of how we have weaponized language and taken on the role of policing the way we talk about issues. And the policing happens within groups and across groups, you know, regardless of where you are on the political spectrum. The policing of moderate language is something that used to drive me crazy. I'm not moderate. I'm going to make a statement here, mm-hmm. and I don't mean it to be triggering, but I mean it to be attention getting.
Okay.
The only book on prayer that I have ever read that was worth reading, mm-hmm. was a book called Primary Speech.
Yes.
By Anne and Barry Ulanoff.
I read that book, absolutely.
And mm-hmm. for Anne and Barry Ulanoff, I'm asking you to just hold reactions to the word prayer.
Yep.
For Anne and Barry Ulanoff, communication that carried in words, because they were looking at verbal prayers, mm-hmm. with associated gestures or tones in the simplest, most direct, unedited manner, yes. called primary speech, that gets at the core of the humanity of the speaker.
Yep.
When you speak out of the core of an experience, no one can argue with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because yep. you have named yep. and claimed the very ground of your life. They may have had a different experience,
mm-hmm.
but you have spoken yep. truth. That doesn't dispel anybody else's truth or the fact that you may discover a different truth down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And they take that idea of primary speech and apply it to every dimension of life.
Absolutely.
Sexuality, mm-hmm. Health, pain management, all of these relationships with family members, all of these things are the subject of primary speech.
Yes.
So how do we move from policing a world to correct people using language in ways we find offensive to drawing out of the world more accurate statements of our condition, each one of us? How do we make that move to fostering? My longstanding interest is in participatory democracy, mm-hmm. the only real democracy, because it's not a majoritarian or a minoritarian
thing.
It's where everybody shows up and negotiates in their interactions, and almost all of their interactions are accompanied by language.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I see the democratic process as an exercise in primary speech. It's an exercise in prayer, pleading our cases in public for the lives that we have and want to live. Mm-hmm.
You know, if somebody said to me, and they have, that the word church is triggering, and that has happened, and they really wanted to engage in a conversation about it, I'd be very happy to do that, because I love listening to what people have to say. Right. I love listening to people's right. processes. But that's never where it really is. It's really about just shutting me down or shutting the other person down. And expressing whatever their opinion is about the word.
Mm-hmm.
It's never a conversation. Like, the person never turns around to me and says, why do you use that word?
Right, right.
What does that word mean to you?
Right, right, right. So
the first reaction is to attack me for using it, not to even ask me what it means to me.
Right, and so to use a word I used earlier, to be a skillful fighter,
mm-hmm.
is to come back and to say to them,
yes,
where do you find companionship in tough times?
Mm-hmm.
Where do you find, who do you talk with when you need to consider things that are bigger than yourself?
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Where do you go to experience that? Mm-hmm. Now, my father got frustrated with the church and quit attending. Yeah. And he found church in nature, which is a real common experience that a lot of people have. Yeah. He was also a Boy Scout leader in a town and an elder in some ways, even though he was too young. But when people have to answer, when you ask people the question to which church was the answer for you, then they have to figure out what their analog is. And it's a technique in fighting. It's just like kind of martial arts where you use the force of the other to kind of flip them over. And what may happen is they learn a new balance.
Exactly. And all of that is so true. And I think that I also want to bring in the perspective that there are times when I don't feel like doing that.
You can walk away.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like racism.
That's interesting. I love the church.
Exactly.
I've had some of the best fights in life I've ever had in the church. I've had some of the most wonderful moments of love I've ever had in the church. I love the church.
Or I remember the great candy they used to serve. Exactly. You know, that kind of thing. You know, and I do.
Those chocolate donuts.
Yeah, exactly. I think that I want to also look at the angle of just taking it easy, right?
Yeah.
Let's take it easy.
Yeah.
And stop beating each other over the head every opportunity we feel we have to do that.
Yeah.
That's basically what I'm trying to get back to. And if you really want to have a conversation, that would be amazing if that's what you really want to do.
Right. But you can't even say that.
Right.
Because it makes things self-conscious.
Yes.
But if that's the attitude that you're interacting with, then whatever you do, you won't be tight.
Right.
You won't appear to be holding back kind of violent words or challenging comments.
Yes.
You will just be relaxed.
And you could have a much better conversation that way.
Yep.
So much better. Because you're never thinking I have to be in the defensive posture.
Right.
And so I don't even want to call it a technique. It's just a way of being.
Well, and I want to call it a technique.
Because okay, cool.
I think sometimes people need to have things named that they can do. And I have been criticized, and maybe this is my overreacting. I have been criticized for making observations, but people walking away, but I don't know what to do.
Yes.
So labeling things as technique sometimes allows people to take that piece and work with it.
Okay, good.
But the technique is not an answer.
Right.
It's a tool.
Right.
It's just it's an adequate tool. And you know, it's a situation where if you only have one or three techniques,
that is exactly
then you're really going to be limited in the relationships you can build.
That's right. Right. And the technique you employ depends on so many factors, right?
Yeah.
It depends on who I'm talking to in the first place. If I already know they have a history of just somebody like always wants to engage in a fight, I already got that. If I know they're a person who really is curious about asking these questions or really feels authentically like, you know, I'm struggling with that. Right. I would love somebody to say to me, I'm struggling with that word, right, instead of don't use that word because it makes me triggered.
Right.
That's what I would love to hear. You know, it opens up a whole different world of understanding, a whole different world of compassion, and a whole different way of having the conversation to begin with.
Right, right.
But that's not the habit we're in now as a culture.
Right.
We're in the habit of controlling what people do.
And
you know?
Yes, yeah. One of the words that kicked off this these efforts, the image that I have in mind are two roughly equally sized persons of ambiguous gender or whatever gender you want, each with their hands on the throat of the other.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're doing, is we're strangling each other.
Yeah.
And it began with the current version of it began with the use of the term God.
Okay, yep.
Inserting that use into the pledge in the 50s, fighting that use, fighting, fighting about what we kind of have to have in common versus what we just need to live.
Yes.
Whether it's common or not.
Right, exactly.
You know, and we have, so anyway, I guess I'd like to spend the last few minutes of this show with that word God.
Okay.
Because I know that that's also been a triggering word for people in your current work situation.
Yeah.
And it's been a triggering word for people in my situation, and at the expense of repeating myself, but unless you listen to all the shows, you won't have heard this before. My whole life changed. I have a tendency to believe that I have the most to learn from the people who are least like me.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's really wonderful. And sometimes I should just be quiet and walk away.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So learning that, but at one point after 15 to 20 years of relationship with a person, I said, who was an atheist, who was kind of from a family that was viscerally, verbally hostile to religion.
Yep.
I said, I don't believe in the God you don't believe in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that was liberating to me.
Good.
In an incredibly powerful way.
Yeah.
Because it summarized a difference.
Very good, yeah.
And because I could do that without condemning her or affirming myself, it was just, I don't believe in the God you don't believe in.
Yes, yes.
And in that process of becoming more subtle, because it's required and I've always had a funky relationship with the term God. In that it's a summary word.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time it's invoked to summarize the bigness that is beyond our comprehension and control.
Sure.
So it doesn't have any substantive content. It doesn't have any literal meaning. It certainly isn't some old white guy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's something that exceeds our comprehension and control, which we acknowledge our subjectivity, our humility, our need.
Yes.
And so at that level, and it also invites us into possibilities that are beyond our comprehension.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so that creates things to be discovered where we may be feeling led, but I couldn't argue convincingly that I was led there, but it happened. It opened up. I don't want to get lost in the details of this.
No.
This is a space where when we have fundamental value differences, finding ways to describe each other without condemning each other allows us to thrive. The possibility of thriving because we're not trying to control each other anymore.
That's right. That's exactly right. And we have to get out of that. Out of that conditioning, out of that habit of trying to control one another, because that's really what we're doing. And like I said, it's doing great. It's separating us. It's not bringing us together. It's dividing us greatly.
Right. But when we come together, one of the assumptions, and I see this in groups all the time, is that we come together about what we have in common. That's a mistake. We come together simply to be together.
Yeah, that's the way I see it.
And we don't have to share any values or anything, but the way we interact is how we are together.
Mm-hmm.
If I need to walk away because the way we are together doesn't allow me to be, that's a statement of how we are together.
That is right. Yes, right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so the whole point
if someone invites me somewhere, I don't think, oh, do we have anything in common? I'm open to hearing. Right.
But whenever you But so we are in political season right now.
Yes.
And the assumption is, if we can't get the other side, if we can't either dominate them out of existence or recognize this common thing that
right.
we really have to, everybody bow down to this common thing, which is not helpful.
Not at all.
And the reason that I wanted to kind of focus our last comments on the term God was because we are engaged in this, in the policing of language is religious warfare.
I agree.
And the people who least see themselves as least religious are often the most ardent perpetrators of religious warfare.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
And sometimes explicitly religious people are, but very sure. often it's the secularist
yeah.
from a modernist background.
That's right. That is right.
Or from a political opportunist.
Background. That is exactly right. That's right.
And we have too much to lose. So to follow up on this,
yeah.
And to preview where we may go next time, what do we need to be thinking about in terms of being with each other? So in this time where we are being policed by our political friends and enemies,
yes.
How do we let that effort fall off us like water off a duck's back, so that we have an opportunity to move forward and to expose the weaponizing and policing for what it is,
yes,
rather than really exploring the needs we have and the resources we have.
Yeah,
somewhere in there was a question.
Yeah, I love that. You know, it's almost as sometimes I always feel like in order to get to the place you want to go, you have to walk backwards away from the center of it. Like if we're talking about the idea of policing words as a way of, for me, as a way of not only controlling somebody else, but also by focusing attention on our own needs as opposed to the person we're standing in front of.
Right. Or holding them as equally important but different.
Yeah, I never see it as equal, I have to tell you.
Well, no. The emphasis is on important. Equity is the basic.
Okay.
And equity emphasizes difference.
Yes, yes. So I feel as if we have to, part of what we have to have a conversation about is what is it that we feel we don't have control over mm-hmm. that makes us want to control people through this minutia, through these words that we lend these associations to. What is it? Because that in itself tells me you want to control something. Even without me being there, the fact that you did that you take this word, you turn it into a monster, and then you spend your life beating down the monster is an act of trying to control something. What is it that we're trying to control that makes us relate in this kind of way,
right.
you know? And how, and then of course, the other side, the immediate other side of that question is, if we can tease that out, then what can we put back in place to make us relate to one another in a much more mutual, loving way, non-defensive way?
Right.
So that we can get things accomplished and not get stuck right. on words that do not have to be taken offensively.
Right, right, right. So this is what you just said made me think about and made me feel something. Coming from a cultural and economic backwater, with people who had a tremendous sense of personal agency.
Mm-hmm.
Some did and some didn't.
Okay.
And especially, it was more strong among farmers than it was among small town folk.
Okay.
And more strong among those farmers who who had learned how if you treat your animals really well, they produce well. Mm-hmm. Whereas those farmers who were living on the edge or had suffered from addiction or being manipulated by banks or debts, they could often be more volatile and more angry. And they didn't have a sense of agency because they didn't have it.
Yeah.
But so what I see is when we try to socialize people or we try to civilize them, when we do that by coercion, which this policing of words is an act of coercion.
Yeah.
Weaponizing language is an act of coercion. When we do that, we are causing people to live inauthentic lives, like you started mm-hmm. with at the beginning. Mm-hmm. But when we draw out of people what they know and what they need and step in to build the structures that accomplish that and also help them discover where they may be a little foolish or unrealistic or not see things clearly.
Good.
That correction is not based on coercion. That correction is based on their running into a wall that they cannot fix.
That is right. That is right.
And that is honest learning.
Yes.
The rest of it is ideology.
Yes.
The enforcement of ideology.
Yes.
And so to me, get in response, that's the alternative to this policing is, and it happens because people confuse the need to civilize others or to socialize others with the need to come together with the working arrangements that allow us to move forward that minimize the damage we would do to each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that repair the damage we've already done.
Yes.
Where possible.
Yes. And the interesting thing is they're trying to, let's say, civilize another, control them, whatever.
Right.
Without even taking that person in account.
That's right.
That's what's crazy.
That's right.
About
that's
it.
Right. That's right. They're not relating to the human being.
Right.
It's
that's
like
what's
the
crazy.
Structure exists regardless of any person.
Yes.
And one the thing that caused me to kind of flip out in, as a sophomore in college was that professors would talk about institutions doing this and institutions doing that. And I would said, I have never, you know, the only biologically, scientifically, rationally, a person acts. They may have in their head an ideological structure. They may have in their head a social structure, assumptions about civilization, but that person is acting. If I want to change that institution, I have to work on that person as well as the things in their heads, and I can't make them change. They have to choose. So they have to want to know that things could be different.
That's right.
And
that's
I have to want to know them to have a relationship.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm so glad that someone finally said that. People say that all the time. The institution, as soon as I said, institutions are created by people and individuals. Yep. If I change the person and the individual, the institution would be completely different. So that's what we have to work on, you know,
right.
And it's interesting. And it's just really this way of, and similarly, it's like triggering. It's like this blaming the abstract.
Right. Or assuming that you change the big picture by manipulating the person.
Right. Right.
And that doesn't work.
No, it does not.
Because the person is helping to create the big picture, and you need them as an ally.
That's right.
Or you need to neutralize them as an enemy.
Yes.
And not let them put yourself in a state of enmity either.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Peaches, any idea for what music we should close the show with?
You came up with some really good songs. There's a song called Words by Neil Young. It might slip in there nicely.
Sure. Okay. Thank you, Peaches. And this is the Made of Clay Report, Facing Our Lives. Peaches Gillette and Eric Clay are your co-hosts. We welcome your comments on any aspect of this conversation about weaponizing language and policing the use of words with each other. any comments, any suggestions you have, call 607-319-5445, extension 6, and leave a message. That's 607-319-5445, extension 6, and leave a message. Or you can write an email to info@madeofclay.org. This show is available online at madeofclay.org. Again, 607-319-5445, extension 6, or info@madeofclay.org.
Thank you. And we need this conversation to be much larger. We need many voices involved in this conversation.
Right. So yes. So that we need it. What we are doing is because, you know, as two people doing this on a volunteer basis, we have a lot of friends. We have a lot of conversations. That's the nature of our lives. But we need you to step up with your comments and also to come on to the air with us in conversation. We pre-record these shows. We may do them live as soon as we can, but we need your voices with us.
Thank you, Eric.
Thank you, Peaches. Until next week.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This one.